My name's Simon Horman. Most people call me Horms. I'm going to be talking about a project I've been working on for a while now, which is perdition. Perdition is an English word for hell, as you can read up there. Hopefully using this software won't cause your life to become perdition. The name is actually derived more from my state of internal well-being at the time I started the project rather than the project itself. Everything I talk about today will go up to that URL sometime soon. Sure. Is that right? Is that better? Is that better? Okay, everything I talk about today will go up onto that website shortly. So you don't have to write too much down. So what is perdition apart from a state of hell? It is a non-caching POP and IMAP proxy server. So most people are familiar with the SQUID proxy server for HTTP. It's kind of like that, except it's for email and it doesn't remember anything. So it proxies connections to the real server. So in this talk, I'll be talking about real servers. They're the actual mail servers where the mail is sitting. I'll be talking about end users. They're the people sitting at home trying to read their mail. And I'll be talking about the perdition director, which is the machine that's running the perdition software. So it directs connections to the real server based on looking up in a POP map, a database, which I call a POP map. It can also use information supplied by the username. So if you log in as user at server 6 dot whatever, it can use that information. Obviously, that's something you want to configure. And it can also just use a pool of servers in round robin that it goes through. The POP map lookup, so the database lookup, is implemented as a module which is loaded up at runtime using DLOpen. It's got an open API. So what this means is that you can implement any sort of database lookup you like. It can be something like a traditional database, like maybe Postgres or a Berkeley DB. It could be something like a regular expression map. It could be a hash. It could connect to an external program. It can do anything. And this is quite powerful. And a lot of people sort of contact me and they're like, oh, we want to do this weird thing, and can you extend your program to do it? And it's sort of like, no, just go and write a module, and it'll work. So it's very, when I first wrote this, it was to do load balancing. But since then, a lot of people have asked for a lot of different features, and it's become quite flexible in the way that it works. And because of this, it could be used in a number of different ways. Of course, load balancing. You can use it for integration, which is, say you have two organizations which are joining together and you want to merge the mail systems together, it can be used for that. If you use it for migration, migration is where you have a new mail server and an old mail server, you want to gradually move people over. It has SSL and TLS support, so you can use it for bridging SSL services and non-SSL services. And you can use it in the firewall, though I wouldn't really recommend it. I'll go into that a little bit. So, I'm sorry the diagrams look a bit weird. I had this bright idea this morning to do reverse video. And so the diagrams look a bit strange, but each one of these blobs is just a computer running something. So the way perdition works is it handles the authentication phase of a connection. Both POP and IMAP have this concept of an authentication phase, and then the phase after authentication where all the interesting stuff happens. The nice thing about the authentication phase is that even for IMAP, which is quite a complicated protocol, it's quite simple. You only have to handle a small subset of the commands. That's all perdition worries about. All it wants to do is get the username and password from the end user and use that to make a decision and then pass a connection to the real server. Once that connection's been established, all it does is pass bytes between the two. It doesn't interpret the data. It doesn't check to make sure it's syntactically correct. It doesn't change the data. it just passes it between the two machines. So there's a few things that can happen in the authentication phase. So firstly, the user may request the capabilities of the server. This is primarily an IMAP thing, although POP also has capabilities. Needless to say, partition in the authentication phase doesn't have a whole lot of capabilities. So it's really just it returns a string, but it has a default string. You can change it. You should change it to match whatever your real servers would spew out. Otherwise, you can get strange things happening later on. The main purpose of the capability string at this stage is to work out whether or not you want to do TLS. And TLS basically involves you have a plain text connection, you request it to become TLS connection, and from then on in, using SSL or TLS to do an encrypted session. So the idea of that is that, so you have HTTP and you have HTTPS, and you have the same with POP. You have POP and you have POPS. But that requires the end user to make a decision about, do I want to do plain text or do I want to do encrypted? The idea of SSL is it's all running through the same port. And the idea of TLS is it all runs through the same port, and the user and the server negotiate whether or not the connection is going to be encrypted. And of course, either end could have a mandatory constraint that, in fact, that they're not going to continue with the connection unless some level of encryption could be negotiated. Anyway, so after TLS has been negotiated or not, as the case may be, the user puts their username and password in, and then partition makes some decision based on that information and makes a connection through to the real server. It uses the same username, or the same password supplied by the user, end user, and usually the same username, although it can do a substitution on the username based on the database lookup. If it's unsuccessful, obviously the connection can't go any further. It returns an error to the end user, and they can try again. If it is successful, it just pipes the data between the two machines from then on in. So any commands that the back-end server can support, particularly with IMAP, because there's so many different things it can do, anything that the real server supports, the end user can use. Anything it doesn't support, it can't. Once authentication is complete, partition is really a non-issue. And, yeah, so as it says, it doesn't try and interpret these commands. And that has, the real thing is that people are like, oh, we could use this for a firewall, and we can protect our network. It's like, well, maybe you can, but don't forget that once authentication is over, any bogus commands that come through, any attempts to maybe do buffer overflows or this type of thing, partition will just pass them straight through. You're not going to protect any sort of dodgy server you have behind there or dodgy clients. So one of the cool things that we can do with our SSL and TLS support is it doesn't matter if you have SSL or TLS or plain text coming in. You can do whichever three you have. You can have any of the three coming in, and you can do any of the three coming out. So let's say you have some funky POP server that you really like using, but it only supports plain text because it was written quite a long time ago. You can still use that, and you can also offer an SSL-based service to your users by just sticking partition in front of it. And partition, of course, can run on the same machine that the real server and the partition director can be the same machine, of course. So this allows you to bridge services. And as time goes by, this becomes less and less useful because the POP and IMAP daemons themselves have native support. But it really can act as a bridge, and that's very useful. The only thing to learn out is that it can't bridge between POP and IMAP. If you're making a connection to the POP, to partition as POP, then it can only speak POP out the other end, and vice versa. And the reason for this is, firstly, the two protocols aren't really that compatible. Secondly, after authentication, it doesn't understand what's going on anyway. So even if it could do this, once you'd authenticated, then suddenly you'd be sending the wrong type of commands through, and it just doesn't really work. So the guts of Perdition is this thing called the PopMap, the database. And this is used to determine which server to connect the real server DOM to. It's a library that's loaded at runtime. This is a list of ones we have at the moment. And of course, you could define arbitrary ones. The original one was this one here, the GDBM one, which is just a simple key value pair database. A lot of people seem to like the LDAP one. LDAP is a pretty well-suited database to this kind of lookup, where you're just looking for a small amount of information, key value pair type stuff, and you want it to be a very lightweight kind of lookup. But by defining new maps, you can do pretty much anything. You can do the database thing, you can do an algorithm, or you could just have an external program like the dynamic feedback that Jeremy Kerr was talking about yesterday, or anything at all. You could also write a program that takes into account some system-specific parameters that you need to, maybe you actually need to look up this database and then using that value look into this database and then use a hash or something like, something strange like this. That can all be just buried in the module, just buried away. So the input for this is provided by the end user. So when their mail client enters the username and password, this is the username forms the information. So the username is split. As it's supplied by the end user, we call that the long username. And if the long username is of the format user at domain or user hash domain or whatever, that into the short username and the domain. So using this information, so we have the long username from the user, the short username, we have the domain. The domain delimiter is configured at runtime. We can also determine things about the IP address and the port which is used. And using this, we can basically a query key, and the query key is a comma delimited list of things to search the database for. So in this example, we're looking for the short username, the domain delimiter, and the destination IP address. And if we can't find that in the database, then we look for the username, the domain delimiter, and then just the string default. And if we can't find that, then it fails. So the idea of this is usually you just don't want to do one lookup, but if you have a complicated situation, maybe you're merging different systems together, you might want to have a series of tests you go through and then maybe a default you have. And this allows you to do that. You'll notice that it does, as well as the information about the username, it can use the IP address information. This is important because it means that Perdition can act as multiple different. If you have different IP addresses for the server, then it can use the information about which one was connected to as part of the database lookup. So it means you can advertise different names for the server with different IP addresses, and they'll be treated differently. So the result that comes back is the server to connect to. The server can also have a port to connect to, and it can also have the username, which allows you to do username translations if necessary. So you can imagine you might be in a situation where you're trying to merge some mail systems together, and two users have the same username. This allows you to change those usernames so they're unique. But what if there's no result? What if we can't be found in the database? Well, when I first designed it, that meant that you lose, basically. But now what happens is that you can supply a list of default servers to connect to. And so if the user isn't found in the database, you go through the default servers in round robin. And in some circumstances, you don't actually want to do a database lookup at all. You might just want to do this purely for load balancing. And you don't actually, and all of the real servers have all the information for all of the users. So you don't really care which one it goes to. So you can do no pop map lookup at all by using a null pop map. And then it will just round robin through them all without doing a database lookup at all. So This is, okay, so far I've talked about what partition is and how the pop map works, how we can do SSL. I'm going to talk just a little bit about, it's just a slight tangent about pop before SMTP. Now, usually when you have a mail server sitting out on the internet, you don't want to just be anonymously relaying email for people. And the reason for this is that people can use it to send spam, and that's bad. But just only relaying mail for your internal network is okay, but what happens when people go traveling? Like, we're all here today. Most of us have traveled a little way to come today and maybe want to send some email. Well, it's kind of nice to be able to relay that email for those people and authenticate them somehow. Now, we can do this using SMTP auth, but sometimes that's not the best solution. To use POP before SMTP or IMAP before SMTP. So basically the way that this works is quite simple. Is the user logs in to read their email, and if they've logged in to read their email, then they probably are who they say they are because they've got the username, they've got their password. So for all intents and purposes, they are that person. So it records the IP address that they come from, puts in a database. And it keeps it in that database for a short time, and anyone who sends email from that IP address is allowed to relay mail for that time. It's pretty straightforward. So the idea is that you go over to the physics building, you plug your laptop in, you log in, you pop your email down, and now if you try and relay email out, it goes, oh, it's the same IP address that we saw you come in from 2 minutes ago. I'm going to assume that you're the same person and let the mail through. So partition has support for doing this by providing a separate daemon which monitors the partition log files, puts them in a little database, and then when the mail transfer agent wants to relay some mail, it looks up that database indirectly or directly and allows it or disallows it. The implementation of this particular part of partition is quite new and quite primitive. It only supports the Berkeley database because that was the quickest and easiest thing to do at the time. Keeping in mind that this is sort of database really is just a key value pair kind of thing, probably a good way to go if you distribute it between would be to use something like TDB REPL, which is a replicated, it basically takes TDB and allows you to replicate it across different hosts. The nice thing about TDB REPL is it's very fast. The not so nice thing about it is that sometimes it loses data. But in this case, it's not that important because the user's going to be coming in and getting their email over and over and over again. So if you lose a value, it'll just get recreated anyway. So how does this tie into the MTAs? Well, with SendMail, it can access the Berkeley DB directly. It's just one of those things that SendMail does, along with everything else it does. Qmail, usually when you send mail into a Qmail server, it spawns a copy of Qmail send or something like that. Just write a wrapper program around the front of that, which sets an environment variable based on the database lookup. Postfix should be able to work the same way as SendMail, but you just need to tweak the database a little bit. Others, I'm not really sure about. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about different things you can use partition for. Load balancing, integration, joining, migration, moving people from between different systems, and firewall. So the load balancing scenarios, that's where it all started. It's fairly straightforward. We have an end user. They connect to the POP server, which is actually not really a POP server at all. It's just partition running the proxy software. And then we've split our users up. We might just split them alphabetically for this example, but we could split them anyway at all. So we have A to H on one machine, I to P on the next, and Q to Z on the last machine. So, of course, you do this because your mail system's too big for one machine. And So, the split can be made very easily. And the way we can do this split is, if we're doing it alphabetically, we can just use a regular expression to match the users. If it starts with eta h, then the result is real server 0 for the other three servers. Of course, that's a fairly blanket approach, and it doesn't really take into account the fact that people might move, you might want to grow the database different ways. So for that reason, you might want to use an actual database which allows you to have individual mappings. And of course, as I mentioned before, a custom database can be written if you need to take into account different things specific to an environment. So that's load balancing. The next thing you might want to do, so in Australia a long time ago we had hundreds and hundreds of ISPs, and then broadband came along, and you can't have all these little tiny ISPs offering broadband because the overhead of providing it's kind of a bit high. So what happened is all the ISPs got bought up by the big ISPs. So there's a lot of consolidation going on, and when you merge ISPs together, one of the things you want to do is basically take the email infrastructure and the web serving infrastructure and all the other types of infrastructure you have and consolidate them together. So one of the problems of consolidating email infrastructure is that you always get name clashes, especially with common names like Bob, John, you know, Jane, all these things. These things are always like, if you have three small ISPs, they'll all have this common set of users. And you can't really say to the users, well, you know, we merged with this other company, now you've got to change your name. So what Petition can allow you to do is to map these usernames. So here we have the example of two Bobs, Bob at Foo and Bob at Bar. And what we want to do is be able to map these to Bob 1 and Bob 2. So we have the two Bobs, but we need some way of differentiating between the two. Now, if they've been inputting their domain name as part of their username, like this, so when they log in, he actually logs in as bob@foo.com, and the other Bob logs in at bob@bar.com, then that's okay, because we can use that information as part of the database lookup. That's simple. Just 1 minute. Sorry. Somebody thought they would call me. Now, if they supply the domain name, that's easy. Otherwise, we need to use some extra information. And the other way to do this is to have your partition director with two IP addresses. So we set that up, and we set up the mapping in DNS as well. So 3.foo.com. going to 10.0.0.1, and we have pop3.bar.com going to 10.0.0.2. The end user comes in, Bob1 will connect to 10.0.0.1, Bob2 will connect to 10.0.0.2, and as I showed before, in the query keys, IP database lookup, and that given that information, we can differentiate the two to different local usernames, and that's all fine and dandy from there on in. So the analogy here is that to using the information supplied by the user is a little bit like using a name-based virtual host with Apache. And using this approach with the two different IP addresses is much more like using an IP-based virtual host. The only difference is that people generally aren't in the habit of giving their domain name as part of their login name, unless they've been told to do that from the beginning. So migration. So let's say that an old mail server that you've been using for years, and you decide that you're going to have a new one, maybe a whole new cluster of new ones, whatever you want to do. But you know, a little bit unsure about this. You don't want to sort of switch everyone over like this. Maybe you want to have a beta phase. Maybe you want, there's actually a few, like, maybe a very, use up a lot of resources on the old mail server, so you want to move them over without telling them. Maybe you want to be able to slowly move people over and then move them back if it doesn't pan out so well. Whatever you want to do. So the way to do this is basically you take your old server, you put the partition director in front of it, so it gets the IP address for the POP server, and then you put your new real server behind that as well. And then you do the switch over, you set the values in the POP map according to where you want everyone to go. Or maybe you could do it such that you have the POP map for all the people going to the new real server, and if that fails, then the default server is the old real server, or vice versa, whatever you want to do. And of course, once it's all working perfectly, then you can take the partition director out and put the IP address back to the new onto the new real server, and you're back to the two machines. So I've actually seen an example of why you want to do this, but I get lots of email from people going, we want to do this, so apparently it's done. So the last one is the firewall. So you can use partition as part of a firewall. It's a proxy server, just like Squid is. It can forward users' connections to a default server. So I guess that would be the situation where you put partition on the outside of the network, on the edge of the network, and you have your real servers inside the network you're trying to protect. It can also use have the end users inside the firewall, and you want to allow them out maybe to a specific server, perhaps a server in the demilitarized zone. It can also use information from the end user. So, for instance, our friend Bob comes into POP3. Oh, there's a dot missing. POP3.foo.com. It can interpret that as Bob is asking to connect to POP3.foo.com. Partition can also authenticate the users at this stage, so it can check the password. But this is rather limited because the password has to match whatever the password is on the external server. And the reason for that is that, well, basically during POP and IMAP authentication, there's only really room for one password. So you can't really have two, unfortunately. But the real catch in one of the things you want your firewall to do is you don't just want to control who's getting out to which ports. You really like to make sure that all the information coming in is actually clean. So say, for instance, you're running a particular IMAP server that is known to have a buffer overflow in a particular command. You kind of like to filter that out on the way in. But because partition doesn't understand these commands at all after authentication, it can't do that at all. It could be extended to do that, but the amount of logic in the core of partition would probably go from sort of this much to... Because you could write a module hook to do it, but what I'm saying is that you'd probably be better to write the whole thing from scratch. You're not really going to get much for free. You could definitely mine a module hook, and I can show you exactly where to put it in the code. But it's definitely non-trivial. And especially POP is okay, because it's such a simple protocol, but IMAP is... First time I read the IMAP IRC, I was like, someone wanted to have something to do for a long time. I mean, IMAP's a great protocol, but it's incredibly complex, especially compared to POP. So how can you get your hands on this great code? Well, it's implemented in C, so hopefully it's nice and fast. And sometimes it has memory leaks and things like that. And the sort of people who use software like this are sort of sysadmin types, and some of them can't really code very much, other than maybe in Perl and Python. And they're like, oh, this memory management stuff, we're going to have to do this more. It's deliberately written in C to keep it fast and not rely on too much stuff. I develop all my stuff on Linux, so it works on Linux pretty well. It also, but most of the people who use it seem to use it on Solaris, so it also works in Solaris pretty well. It is included in FreeBSD, so I assume that it works there. And it should work on pretty much everything. But of course, there's always little bugs, and usually build problems. It's available on the, from that URL up there. It's also available in Debian and FreeBSD. But currently, I was hoping to get 1.11 out before. There's a few little niggly bugs that we're trying to iron out, and so that will be coming too. And of course, if I send me my a patch, then I'll be very happy. So wake up in the morning, I read a patch, then I'm, it's a good feeling for the day. So I had a really crappy conclusion for this talk, and then Alex, who gave the previous presentation, read it and told me how crap it was. And he said, why don't you go and find out if anyone's using this? So I did. And I was quite astounded that so many people were trusting their email to me. And they were the ones I was allowed to publish. But needless to say, it's been around for a little while now. And those figures reflect, quite a lot of people are using it. So you should feel reasonably comfortable with using it. Of course, there are always little bugs. And that's why you send me patches. So that's pretty much the end. As I said, the information will be up on this URL. That's also the URL to download the code. There's information about CVS and mailing lists and all that sort of exciting things. And that's it. Thank you very much.